Hello, and welcome to recording number 37 of Gary Gygax's Saga of the Old City, an annotated reading. Today is July 18th, 2021. We're starting in the middle of the big battle between the Overking's army and the woods folk of the Adri Forest. We've done about an hour and a half or 2 hours so far of the battle. And to recap a little, the woods folk have managed to ambush at Woodsford, and this is called the Battle of Woodsford. The forces of the Overking, the elite scouting forces, have been wiped out. And at this point, they've performed a second ambush on the elements of the main Ivid army force, and things are now at the point where the infantry polearmers have come across the very lead elements of the main army are mostly wiped out, but it's a very big army, and there's only six plus or so thousand of these woods folk fighting against them. There are about 6,000 wood folk and a number of druid spellcasters, and then there are also the river folk, which are an unnumbered force. Gygax never mentioned the numbers of river folk that would be defending at Woodsford. The ambushes have gone very well, but at this point, the army's so large that they have forced their way across the river. And first these polearm troops, and now the elements of the Ivid's royal guard, who are cavalry, more heavily armored, and they're fighting in the river itself. And that is causing, you know, a lot more casualties for the woods folk, who are now forced out of the woods and their ambushing position. So that is at the point we stopped. And today, I'm going to restart. It is page number 274, the final paragraph. All right. Gord saw that the cavalrymen, most of them dismounted now, were slowly breaking off and falling back. Supporting them were a body of mercenaries and a group of men armed with long volges. Gord realized that fresh contingents of the Overking's large force had managed to cross the river and take up formation. Through breaks in the crowd of warriors, he could see that beyond these newly arrived soldiers were a great cluster of men still waiting the ford. Then the rain sheeted down again. His vision was obscured. Gord prepared himself for the end, silently cursing himself for ever wishing to have seen a battle between armies. "Stop gawking at the frigging enemy and get the hell out of here," Church shouted in his ear. Gord started and looked around. The woodsfolk were sprinting westward into the trees, away from the Imperial army. There seemed to be a few hundred newly arrived warband members there trying to make a rear guard for the exhausted, beaten remnant now in flight from the ford. A few slingers among these newcomers, augmented by stragglers from the worn groups disengaging from combat, enabled the woodsmen to manage a desultory discharge. Ward was glad he had no missiles left and could pass through this line without feeling cowardly. In a few minutes, the woodsmen were clear of the battle scene, and the rain suddenly stopped. Leaders, chiefs, and captains urged the retreating force to hurry on, away from Woodsford and the army that would certainly be in full pursuit. After another 100 yards of retreat, Gord understood the reason for this order, for he and his comrades were passing through a formation of carefully concealed sylvan elves, just taking bows from oiled leather cases and setting spears and swords at ready. There would be yet another nasty surprise for the invading horde before this day ended. break. All right, that's a big surprise for me. There had been no previous mention that that part of this defending ambushing force would include Sylvan Elves. And whether they're native to the Adri Forest, which I would assume from the way this battle has gone that they would have to be, or whether they came in from more of an outside area, it has not been mentioned. There's a few comments here, like Gord, who is cursing himself for wanting to see a battle. And that, you know, this is Gord's first experience, and for a lot of D&D players, back when this came out, I'm not sure how many people had actually put their players through a general battle. You know, players had started out adventuring in dungeons, and then there had from there to maybe city and wilderness encounters, you know, various kinds of quests and such, and you know, the Hill Giant series had taken place and they had gone underground. But at this point, I'm not quite sure how many people had taken the step of introducing characters to a more warfare kind of scenario that was going on. You know, and although it seems a little strange to me that they would try to confront that the woods folk would try to confront the army in the river itself and not withdraw before that. But that's, you know, that is not an unreasonable way that battles actually happen, that no matter what plans you have and no matter what plans the leadership has, things just happen the way they happen. I think something that any DM is fully aware of, that no matter how you run a battle or run a dungeon, the players always have a way of doing the unexpected. And in warfare, the unexpected is normally what occurs. And having the troops rush out and fight in, where they... Yes, no plan survives the contact with the enemy. And that is very true. Very rarely has that ever happened. I know that's something that the Romans fell foul to, because they, the old Roman generals, a lot of them had a book, a set plan of how to counter any resistance. So they fought, and sometimes their enemies knew that book. And so the Romans used to have a plan, and they were so good and in fighting that normally their plans worked against their enemies. Back at the time when most battles and the people they fought against were just kind of these more like wild swirling masses of men, rather than, you know, highly organized troops and plans like the Romans had. All right. You know, in this battle, it is very much like reading an action scene where you might have two individuals fighting. So there isn't, you know, a huge amount of lore. There's certainly a great deal about a way a battle could go, which is good for a DM to pick up, and good for, ideas for players and DMs if you're running this kind of scenario, or even if it's just something that is occurring to the side. So here's the idea of how the battle goes. And now we have the Gordon and his group in retreat. And like I said, the encounter now is with the Sylvan Elves popping up.
I was wondering when the elves were going to show up. I was hoping they would.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I had forgotten them entirely. you know, it's been a couple of years since I read this, and I didn't remember. I actually don't really remember much about this battle at all.
It wasn't really because I remembered it at all. It's just because I know the Adri is one of the it's one of the places the Great Kingdom never fully conquered. There's a number of the forests, I don't think, that were fully conquered. Selene was another one, and I just knew that they were there, but we hadn't seen anything at all about them.
Yes, and one of the things is that no matter this, you know, from Darlene's map, the scale is so large that these are not small forests. You know, I mean, you're talking of dense woodland that is, you know, 100 or more miles across or several hundred miles across. So these are very, you know, like this is a lot of very undeveloped woodland with few, as we've mentioned, it should be very few roads and very small trails, especially like the description of the Thorpe where Stalker and Chert and Curly were at. It was described that place you could not see on because of the woods until you were like right upon it. And if that is the style of the, you know, villages and hamlets and even maybe small towns within the Adri just for the woods folk, then it really does not describe the kind of place that you're going to see anything but, you know, the loosest trails of necessity, you know, that are left there rather than, you know, full-fledged roads. It's not a place, a great place for wagons and not even a great place for horse travel. And the one road that is this one that is going to Woodsford. You know, I mean, it really should be one of the places, the major roads that go through the Adri, because I doubt the elves or the woodsfolk would really encourage anything else. It's to their benefit and their lifestyle that they would not need these, you know, a road system through. All right, and I really can't make out. There's been a map posted to the...
Yeah, that was a map that Gary put up during Jay's show on the Great Kingdom. All right. And it just shows the Elven Kingdoms not really being under control of the Great Kingdom. That's why I posted it.
Okay, I can't really, I see the yellow and the gray, and I can't make out the words, unfortunately, so I really don't, I'm not making out too much about what that is showing.
Basically, the holes, I was focused on the holes in the map, the holes in the yellow, they're the forests.
Okay, so the one on the right
the Adri.
Because that does, now I've got a good, better picture of the Bone March and the surrounding area. Yeah, and without knowing the scale, yeah, it's like a little heart-shaped, not a heart like Valentine heart, but a like a human heart shaped opening there in the, I guess, the control of what the Great Kingdom ever controlled. So, you know, the gnomes of the Gnome Kingdom up in the Flinty Hills and the Adri forests looks to have been forever free of domination. So if there were big opening roads, you would definitely see, you would definitely see, there's the Adri and the Flinty Hills. So those have never been under the control of the Overking and the Great Kingdom. So, you know, that really is, you know, looks to be a little sizable chunk right there. All right. I'm going to restart. The only thing is we have the oiled leather cases and the spears. And just a comment that, yes, you know, you would have your bows cased, which is something not really often mentioned that I've encountered in gaming, is that you would not have the bows strung because you would not want to have the tension on the bows And the string especially, because what will happen is if you leave your bow strung forever, it loses that tension. And if you have your bows, open, just without being cased of any kind, that can start a warping in the wood. So it's not really mentioned, and it's usually just shown people who are wandering around and immediately are pulling out strung bows and arrows knocked all the time. And that really isn't what you should find. You should have to have a little preparation in getting ready. And here we have it, that the elves going through the forest are preparing their bows. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 275, the final paragraph. Finally, hours later, the scattered remnants of the once proud assemblage of free forest fighters began rallying in a small valley south of the battle area. Of the thousands who had gone forth, only about half remained. They were all dejected and downcast when Geller and several other men, accompanied by two women and a slender elf, worked their way through the slumped warriors. Geller's presence heartened the fighters, and he soon had their attention. Gord, Chur, and Wren moved closer to where he and the group with him stood. Geller waved, smiled, and spoke. "What you have done today will go down in the annals of history," he said warmly. "Don't feel defeated. You have won. 6,000 of you have killed or wounded more than that number of the enemy. You have wiped out the advanced division of the Overking's army, mauled his vaunted guardsmen, foot and horse alike, and blunted the edge of Ivid's invasion. You had no choice but to fall back before an enemy that numbered twice your strength. You took the worst of clerics and magicians' spells and held your ground. Only numbers of fresh and heavily armored foes forced you from your slaughter. Now rejoice at this. The Grand Marshal remains in camp at Woodford, afraid to come farther, and he'll soon turn tail and march home to Edgefield. The invasion is over, and you have won the day for us all." Break and end of chapter 25. Well, that's actually very informative right there. I don't remember if Edgefield was mentioned as the invasion point. Edgefield's, right on the east portion of the Eidry Forest. So this road definitely is the road, from the east, not the southern road showed at Woodford. You know, we had this little map of Woodford, and it shows two roads coming to Angleford, but not Woodford. So this really does seem to be, Angleford or Ongleford really does seem to be Woodford, should be on the map. And so there's a couple things that I find, a little out of place would be in these kinds of fights, an army that took, 50% casualties would be generally smashed. It would be very demoralized. Normally, if you have one man dead, you have about four men wounded. A great deal of these people would probably should be wounded. Even in fantasy battle, it's still, supposed to be a battle of, man against man mostly. And a lot of the magic it really was a turning point when the woods folk were forced out of the woods and into the stream to fight on unfavorable ground. Now, I assume that there had to be more than 12,000 or so troops. And if there were, normally if a side loses much more than 10% of in a battle, unless it's a complete massacre, that is a pretty big loss, even for medieval battles, is there have been, you know, several cases when there's been, you know, big slaughters in the past, like Agincourt, and but that normally it doesn't take a huge amount of deaths in a fight for the other side to retreat. And so this would be for the Ivid's army, the loss of 6,000 or more troops, that would be more than, you know, just blunting them. That, depending on the size, even if they had, say, 24,000 troops, if 6,000 are killed, you know, one quarter of their army is destroyed, that would pretty much be the end of that fighting force. It's just, you know, that is a tremendous amount of casualties, and, you know, it really takes a lot for troops to stand and fight to that point before one side or the other breaks. You know, and it sometimes doesn't take much for, you know, troops to break like that. I had assumed things would go a little differently in this fight, and that there'd be less of this stand-up fight between all the woods folk. But, and more of, like, you know, they had the opportunity to ambush the tail of Ivid's foe, you know, pull their troops back from the front, ambush the tail, ambush the middle, because the sides of the flanks of this force that was moving down the road were very exposed to that kind of attack because there were wild woods to either side. But anyway, this is the story of the battle so far.
Yeah, it was going that way in the beginning, where they were ambushing rather than face-to-face melee fighting. But I think, like, at one point, the Overking's army noticed where they were. They gave up their position somehow, and the fight broke down a little bit.
Yeah, that's why what I expected was what happened here, where as soon as they reached the other shore and began engaging them with foot soldiers, although pole-armed foot soldiers, which are pretty and they're not at an equal fight against, you know, more skirmisher-type troops in a deep, dense forest. They can't form up. The long pole arms are, you know, blocked by a lot of bad footing and trees. So I really wouldn't think, but, you know, I mean, it's, this the battles just they go this way. Things happen that don't make sense because of, you know, like Gord talking about what he can see through the other troops. You normally can't. You know, if battles back then were not, they were mass affairs, you know, organized or unorganized, there were these blocks of men. Gord is short. You know, and I doubt that he could see much beyond the first row, but maybe just men two or three behind and get a sense of a pressing crowd. But unless you're at some kind of height advantage, when you're in the middle of that fight, I really wouldn't think he'd see very much one side or the other.
I think the terrain and the narrow road is also probably a big reason for the Overking's losses, the high number, like 50%.
And, you know, it's commented here that, you know, Egg had made a comment that the barbarians didn't seem to be as good at melee, and that just, yeah, I remember that, and it does not make sense to me. But, you know, that they would be bad at melee in, especially in the woods. Now, one of the problems that, you know, has been shown many times is that, barbarians are known for not fighting in a direct formation. The Vikings actually, historically did more of the, of formation fighting than I think popular fiction and movies give them credit for, because one of the very common things is that they had shields, and very large shields that they would use to form a blocking shield wall. and not as effective as, say, like the Roman line of shield, you know, shield bearers, who could also, you know, do this thing that they called the testudo, the turtle, where they would be able to pull their, the front rank would hold the shield in the front, and the ranks further back would actually have the shield held interlocked above their heads, so that if they were being hit by archery fire, they could actually move in this very cumbersome formation with the troops in the center holding up their shields above their heads interlocked, especially when they got more to the rectangular shield usage. Because the Roman troops had, at various times in history, had different armor and different, you know, fighting formations. So it does seem to me there's several things about this that seem out of place, but they're not out of historical, because history shows such a wide variety. And there were plenty of barbarians who were, you know, the cultures that were referred to as barbarians, who had a very wild way of fighting. And they had a lot of this fighting where, you know, I think it was kind of shown in the movie Braveheart, where the troops would be like shouting at each other, and then these leaders and heroes would come out and fight individually, you know, beyond their before the general melee was, you know, encouraged. And then when they would slam together, some of the barbarians fighting barbarians, you know, even people from the same culture fighting each other, they would just become a swirling mass of troops fighting each other. So it's not, you know, it's not possible or illogical for what's happening right here. It just is something that you would say was a big failure on the woods folks' part to rush out from the forest and you know, get everything. But again, if Geller here is correct, and they've killed, and it does seem that they killed that many in those ambushes, that they've killed 6,000 troops, not really, especially of the elite, because you know, the main scouting force was the evil woodsmen, the mercenaries, and such. And if the elite troops who were following, who were, as could be told by the armor of the polearm men who came out, the falchard bearers, and then the mounted knights, you know, the mounted cavalry, if they were really getting slammed very badly, then the follow-up troops weren't of the same quality. That really, you know, that really, you know, would severely cripple and demoralize the army. And if they're planning on going up against a fighting force of fresh men, of that Archibald, you know, the King of Nyrond is bringing to battle, and obviously is going to be forewarned of any ambush, then, you know, really, they are not going to be at the advantage there.
Yeah, I think they pretty much foiled that plan to attack Archibald.
Yeah, yeah. Now, of course, one of the things that should be mentioned, that in battle, the retreating force usually takes the most casualties. When the troops stop turning and they're facing their foes, when they turn their backs, usually that's when the greater amount of casualties occur. At that turning point, when they're running, they're very vulnerable to being run down and killed, because even if they're wounded, and then they're generally abandoned in the retreat, and that's the end of those troops. So yeah, you know, it's when they're ordered to retreat. But so anyway, this is changed a little bit about you know, how things were going, but I didn't expect them to be meant to actually stop the army, but to blunt it like they did. So I'm a little surprised that they would have gone and taken such heavy casualties. All right. You know, we the only thing that I really note about the lore here is that From Woodford, let me see, south of Woodford, there's a small valley. Unnamed, but that's where the defeated remnants of the woods folk are gathering. And it also surprises me that there's no mention at Woodsford along a major road of any kind of village or settlement. I don't know if I missed that, but I don't seem to, there doesn't seem to be anything on there about, you know, a road through the forest. And that could be possible that that kind of thing isn't encouraged. It's just that at any place like that, it seems like it would be a good place to have a little village, an inn, a place to, you know, where people would rest their horses after the long travel from the east and then crossing a major ford like that. There's going to be, especially if there's any kind of wagons being brought through, there's going to be tired horses, injured horses, tired men, and definitely probably broken wagon wheels and axles and such, so that you would imagine that at one side of the ford, or maybe even both, that there would be some kind of village or buildings or inns that would be there, but nothing that I remember was mentioned. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page number 277, chapter 26, the beginning of chapter 26, and the first paragraph. Patchwall, the month called Bright Leaf by Elvenkind, was half gone. The first faint pigments of autumn were beginning to paint the green of Adry's Forest giants in gold, scarlet, and russet. It was time to go. And Gord felt a poignancy he had never experienced in similar situations. Before now, departure had simply meant he would be placing his boots beneath a new pallet. Break. All right, so here's a little bit of lore. In Patchwall, we get the elven name for it, which, you know, is listed in the old setting books, I believe both the Folio and the 83 box set. But here we have that it brings an autumn to the Adry Forest, and that so in that month we can say, you know, the weather is changing, getting colder and causing the change in the colors of the forest with the dying leaves. So it does give us a little idea about, you know, the kind of weather and the, you know, the climate in the area of the Adry Forest. I'm not sure what the equivalency of Patchwall to real earth months are supposed to be, but it definitely, you know, that is the beginning of autumn. And so we can say that wherever that is in the calendar, you know, it does show something of what the climate in the game. Now, you know, there's a lot of weather discussion. I'm not exactly, it's not like, I'm very interested in coinage. So I, you know, really spark up when they start talking about what the coins can buy and the various delineations. But when it comes to the weather, it does interest me, but it's not my forte. So I can't really make much comment without research on what that would mean. But it's definitely, you know, it's definitely a significant comment that autumn in the Adry begins in Patchwall. All right, I'm going to continue here. This is page number 277, second paragraph. Gord tried to identify the reason for his feelings. Did he feel that moving away from this place near the Blemu Hills would finally separate him from Evelé? Oh, that thought was foolish, he decided, for by now she was surely wedded and dwelling far to the north in her new archbaronial state. Then, was it because he had grown unusually fond of the woodsfolk? That was quite possible. Gord admired their friendliness, their camaraderie, and their fighting skill. He was still flushed with pride for the small part he had played in the victory at Woodford. One hates to leave the scene of a success, he reasoned, and this last adventure had certainly been a success for him. break. And I break here because the one comment is I didn't realize that Radic was an archbarony. I guess I could find it, fairly quickly looking at setting information, unless it's something not mentioned before. I did not realize that the Radicers belong to an archbarony. I think that would just imply, I'm not sure of the history here, but it would seem to imply a connection with the Great Kingdom, that, you know, that at one point Radic was connected to it, which is why it would be, you know, instead of a regular barony, a more independent archbarony. Here we have, you know, the assumption that everything's gone well with the wedding of Evely, that she is now married to Elaine, who is the son of the, the Radican leader. Then we just have a little more comment about the success of the Battle of Woodsford, which, I mean, Geller was sedating it was that way, and to Gord's opinion, as it says here, it was a victory. I just find that, you know, such a huge loss of the fighting force of the woods folk, which will take, you know, it will take generations for them to rebuild that strength. If they've lost, 50% of the forces sent out, and that's what they could gather, it just strikes me that it's very hard for me to personally see that as a victory. They did keep the Overking from crossing through the Adri, and possibly if the Overking sees it as too costly to fight against the woodsfolk, then, you know, it does go to say, yes, it was a victory, even if it was a bit of a Pyrrhic victory. And I still have a very hard time seeing how Gygax would credit that kind of loss as victorious, you know, especially as a wargamer and a historian. All right, I'm going to restart here. I've been going paragraph by paragraph. It is page 277, the final paragraph. Chert felt no such pangs, even though he was leaving the area he knew as home. The big man was whistling merrily as he readied his gear for the journey. But after all, this was special for him. The giant had never ventured more than a league or two beyond the timberland, and the prospect of a journey into the outside world excited him. Besides, he and Gord were going with Geller and Curly Greenleaf, bound for the royal court at Rel Mord. Great doings indeed. As Geller had confidently predicted, the survivors of the battle at Woodford did indeed hear news that the Grand Marshal of Airdie had turned his army back toward its starting point, Edgefield, even though the invaders technically had been victorious in the battle. The retreat was an understandable decision. Not only was the Overking's host no longer fit to conduct a long campaign, but the Nyrondal force in and around Nurl would most certainly be alerted and on guard against an attempt to advance farther. With two such marks against him, Grand Marshal Dreek had little choice other than turn back and face the wrath of Ivid. Break. So exactly what we were commenting on is the occurrence here, that the army of Ivid was definitely mauled. I mean, perhaps fairly much decimated if they'd lost, you know, so many. I mean, the word decimated comes from the loss of 1 in 10, and it sounds more like, you know, he lost, you know, 1 in 2, 1 in 3. And then, as we said, the king of Nyrond, his forces would now be informed of the advance and be prepared, which the whole thing was supposed to be a trap with the three forces descending upon him by surprise.
It seems like both of the forces were cut in half.
Yes, only, you know, with the smut much substantially smaller force of the woods folk.
Right.
It's, you know, that they're losing, that they defeated twice as many or more. I think from the description, the army sounded to me to be at least 20,000 or more. Using the numbers that Gygax was stating, that each one of these units was more like 1,000, what he was calling a brigade, was like 1,000 per unit for the Ivid's forces. And we know he killed 1,000. They killed 1,000 in the first ambush to a man or woman, you know. And then they killed... there were lead elements, each about 1,000, that were wiped out. The crossbowmen, the small bowmen, the polearm men, and then mauling the cavalry units, which ended up fighting dismounted. That, you know, if they killed 6,000, you know, that is quite believable. But, you know, that was a very large force coming through, where there was unit after unit being described, and I really thought it was adding up closer to 20,000. But then that also reveals what an army size is. And, you know, the Great Kingdom is so much larger than almost, you know, other than several other big kingdoms. So many of the regions are very low population you know, they should be able to field quite a big army, but how many soldiers the Ivid wants to throw out on one little, you know, attack when he has such a huge kingdom to defend and with lots of troubles at home? Still, you know, that would be a big army at 20,000. You know, so you can see that these are not, you know, not monstrously big, you know, military forces. All right. I'm going to restart. We do get the name of the Grand Marshal Treek. I don't know if he was mentioned before.
Once.
And then there is the business of Archibald making it to Nurl. So I would think that at the very least, Archibald, you know, going to Nurl, remember, he was going there not to fight Ivid. That was going to be the surprise. But he was going there to set up, to make sure that Dunstan, the Count of Nurl, that he would, Blemu, you know, he would be come back more in line and not be thinking of, you know, founding his own little kingdom there. And so he also was going to drain. So everything that Archibald wants to do is still in place. He hasn't lost any men, as far as we know. There's no mention of the northern forces of humanoids or that jackal, what was his, Grenell, coming down and attacking him. And even if he did, both those forces might not be able to do what this army from the Great Kingdom would have been able to do. So... it looks like Archibald, thanks to these woods folk, is able to go there and complete his original plans, which were then to set up fortifications to protect against, you know, encroachment from the north and the northeast.
I think he wants to align with the Radicans, right? So he has access to the sea?
Yes, and what... Yeah, and it's, you know... the old Bone March seems to have included Johnsport. That was lost at the time of Spine Castle and then retaken by, you know, the Radicers or Radicans. And now with the marriage of his vassal, you know, Count Blemu, his daughter, Evely, to Elaine, the son of the Radican Baron, that would then, you know, put an alliance into effect between the two vassals. And by building the fortifications, he would hope to then keep Blemmu from taking that alliance and using it for his own, you know, building up of power and perhaps allowing you know, that whole area independence. He's now succeeded in, you know, not only building defense from the north, but also keeping his own count in line, and then expanding the alliance into the Radicans, and giving him that access to Johnsport. So yeah, Archibald and Nyrond really come out as the big winners on all this. All right, I'm going to. I'm going to restart. We're on page 278. It is paragraph 3. In a way, Gord felt sorry for the soldiers of the retreating army. Many of the woodsfolk immediately opted to follow the enemy on its long trek eastward to harass its columns and exact further vengeance for the invasion of their forest. With them went the elves, for they too sought to deliver a lesson to the trespassers that would be long remembered. Those who remained searched for wounded, cared for their dead, and gathered the spoils of what was a true victory from the field abandoned by the Iridians. A few prisoners were rounded up from their hiding places in the nearby woods. Renegade woodsmen were given swift justice. Mercenaries were warned and set free, warned to get far away as quickly as they could. A handful of guardsmen, most of whom were knights of the Malachite throne, were taken prisoner, and a great debate as to their fate eventually ended in a decision to ransom them, with the money gained thus to be divided among the families of those woodsfolk killed in the fighting. And so we have a couple things here. Because of the nature of the Ivid army, which was not woodsfolk, they really do have to, if they're going to move in any you know, hasty movement, they do need to be in column. So that means instead of, you know, set up in a fighting or defensive formation, they're now, you know, probably side to side on however wide that roadway is. But it does mean that their flanks are now to the widest length of these columns. And, you know, their rear is facing the enemy. And so with the elves and the woodsfolk probably able to move very quickly through those woods, they can just come upon them and ambush the rear. They can ambush the sides. And the way that the formations was, there were very weak center that held the baggage train and the engineers. So, you know, not the best of fighters. And they've already taken out, like they're saying, that great casualties to the Knights of the Malachite throne. And it is interesting to note that that knighthood is only mentioned here in Saga of Old City, just at the initial, and right here is the last place that I found note of it in any source book or module. So maybe the names changed after, you know, Gygax is era here, but I found no other references to this particular knighthood.
It's interesting. I wish we knew more.
Well, and that is one of the nice things about the setting for people developing, is that there are these one line or a couple things that are ripe for detailing. And it's one of my major complaints about later work by Sargent and others is that they weren't trying to give you just enough. They were trying to give you campaign details. And I like the early days when it was the DM who created all these campaign details. From little mentions like this, from Knights of the Malachite Throne, what are they? Well, we know very little about them, so we can create everything else about them. And, you know, as a DM, I like the personalization of the Greyhawk campaign much more than a heavier footprint from later writers, especially Sargent, you know, who detailed quite a bit about this area. Ivid the Undying is a supplement that is all about this area. Although never published, it is commonly available. You can find a copy on the Cannon Fire website for download. We have a comment here that we have, we're going to see quite a few of the young Sylvan elves counting coup on the Iridians after this. And yes, it would be hard to say, but wood elves, Sylvan elves, they should be able to be the fastest moving through the woods. Just, I can't think, I'm sure that's part of the wood lore, but, the lore of the AD&D game is that the movement pace of Sylvan elves through the wood. But they should be very fast. And bowmen should be especially effective on ambushing and general harrying of retreating troops in a way that will not cost them many casualties at all. I'm still astounded by how many casualties that the woodsfolk took in the Battle of Woodsford. All right, we're getting pretty near the end, but I'm going to restart right here. It's page 278 and the second paragraph from the end. A week after the great combat, Gord found it difficult to believe such a battle had been fought at the ford. Only the marks of the spell's destructive forces could be seen. Even these were already being covered by the rampant verdure. The contingent from Stalker's warband was burdened with its share of spoils when it began its march homeward, and it took several days longer to return than the march to the battlefield had required. Even with clerical and druidical healing wounds were evident and painful. Stalker himself had been so badly hurt that Gord marveled that he was able to be up and around in only a few days, let alone able to lead the return of his warband. But lead he did. Eventually the survivors were safely within the precincts of their own community, and life returned to the routine. Save for the trophies displayed on log walls and fireplace stones, and the recounting of deeds told at gatherings, Woodford was again nothing more than a convenient place to cross the Harp River, and hunting, foresting, and mundane concerns of life within the Adry Forest were again paramount. After making his address to the veterans of the battle, Geller went on some sort of mission, as was his wont. Gord had now grown used to his sudden leave-taking and equally abrupt reappearances. Knowing that he would return in good time, Gord took the opportunity to stay with the woodsmen for a while and learn more of the ways of these people and their environment. He occasionally enjoyed the company of his great barbarian friend. Chert was not around too much since he and Wren were keeping company. Curly Greenleaf soon returned to the place, however, and he often had time to spend with the young thief. Gord found this a most acceptable substitute. The druid informed him not only of the forest, but of his persuasion as well. The idea that all things were a necessary part of life troubled Gord. He found that he had to agree with many of the plump fellow's arguments. Without light, who could understand darkness and vice versa? Thus, badness enabled the concept of good to be understood, and the cycle of birth and death, growth and decay, and each other pair of opposites were all part of a wheel that must forever turn if living things were to exist. On matters affecting the woodlands, however, the druid was not so neutral. Gord laughed at this, for the young adventurer had an idea that despite everyone's protests, each had some particular point of view that was held above all. But was held above all others as the ultimate value or truth. Some sought order, others espoused total freedom for the individual. There were groups proclaiming that weal must be brought to all, while their opposites said the strongest must always prevail. Greenleaf's moral and ethical views had their strengths, but Gord also noted weaknesses. He was wise enough not to point them out again after doing so once, for the heated debate that followed was quite enough for a lifetime as far as Gord was concerned. Thereafter, he kept such thoughts and opinions to himself. All said and done, the world seemed a place where man and deity put forth laws. Sorry there. Laws and ideas, dogma and lore to explain that which simply was. The whys and wherefores of it all were inexplicable to Gord. But as long as he managed to feel good and prosper, he was satisfied enough. And one day he was enlightened as to the mysteries of the multiverse. So much the better. But meanwhile, there was life to live. Right, break. So here, we're getting an overview of Gygax alignment system, especially from the neutral point of view. So, we're having, Gord give his own viewpoints and saying, the various things about what is, what is happening, what he has developed, and not really believing, say, in true neutrality, which, affects things. So we can say that here, Gygax is giving a verbal and a kind of atmospheric showing of the how alignment works within the Greyhawk setting. And so the neutral point of view is actually something that is a philosophy and not just some kind of game mechanic in here. And so we have the Druids' neutrality, which Gord kind of follows, but again, it's mentioned he follows it believing in good. So Gord is probably neutral good, according to Gygax's look upon things. But he really seems to be kind of neutral good / evil, according to what you can see of some of his actions. But Gord himself isn't really concerned with ideas and dogmas and such. He's just a more practical belief system of what is just the way it is, and he is quite concerned with himself prospering. In that respect, it really does it shows the limitations in trying to lock a character into a single alignment when following the alignment definitions in the game, characters can act both good and bad, good and evil, lawful and chaotic. I mean, people are complex, and definitely players should be allowed to be complex. And I think that, it's a closer to reflection to see that people have alignments that are their main focus, and then tendencies where they will snap into, contrary alignments. So that's a really interesting point here. I went through a bit right here, and what we also have, Gord is seeing that life returns to normal in the Thorpe, where, Stalker was. And Chert, and yet it doesn't address what should be a major loss of life to the people all through the woods, having lost so many of their, lost thousands of woods folk, and that would be, quite a burden on, a society to lose, their most active members, and it just seems like if it's proportional. Like Gord mentions, it's mentioned that Gord's group lost 6 out of 10 of the members of their squad, and that only Ren, Chert, Gord, and one unnamed figure survived that battle. So, there are, most likely 6 members of that small or at least several members of that small Thorpe who are gone. And that is, every loss is going to be significant. And I just think that, you know, there's no mention of that. I just really find that to be quite a huge loss right there. And that it would have a resounding effect on the woods folk. The way that the huge casualties that came from World War I had a resounding effect on, British society, because that is quite a number of people killed. It's mentioned, I didn't bring it up, that they released the mercenaries, which is very good for spreading warning not to come back to the Adri. They're ransoming the Knights of the Malachite Throne, because that is definitely going to be a source of loot. That is a traditional thing where, nobles and, would be calling out that, mercy, because they would be saying they can be ransomed. So the average peasant or soldier would be very interested in capturing somebody like those Knights of the Malachite Throne. He mentions how much the forest around Woodsford is cleaned up. Yes, I mean, they could, send the bodies downstream. It's no mention what the burial customs or funeral customs were among the woods folk. Did they burn them? Did they bury them? There were quite a few bodies, thousands of bodies left behind there. And they could, most of them, just be, sent further down the stream where it's not shallow. And quite a bit of loot, if you consider that loot is, it's going to be armor, it's going to be weapons, it's going to be, how much of the baggage train got left behind, how many of the nobles, and since they killed troops of better armor, there may be magic items involved in what was left. Now, it seems like, because Ivid's general held the ford area for at least a day, then they would be able to do some looting themselves before the woods folk came and then did more looting. So probably the best of the Iridian armor and loot was taken back with them, but how much of that actually made it to Edgefield being harassed is questionable. Let me just try to add a few things here, because I actually tried to cover quite a bit, and we are at 7:02, so I'm ending up for the night. I think that's really all there that I can think of.
There's a little bit with Gord showing that he's gaining some wisdom in the fact that he doesn't argue with a zealot with Curly at the end. He's like, yes. He said he brought something up once, and it's like, that was enough.
Yes, and I thought that was humorous about how much we contend ourselves with the internet and how much that kind of thing, yep. Especially about Greyhawk lore. And in 85, there was no online in 85, really. I mean, there was the beginning of, email and stuff. So Gygax wasn't familiar with what was to come, the great flame wars of a few years leading, but he was experienced with the fan arguments from a very early time, from back in the 70s at the beginning of the game, the incredible, flame wars that went on at a much slower pace in journals like Laram's and Excursions and the Wild Hunt. And there were dozens of such journals out there, and the larger ones conducted, they were a little like the internet, and they definitely had their very, very angry discussions over gaming concepts. There was a lot of nerd rage right from the very beginning. All right, I'm going to end here on page number 280, and again, we're just probably about 3 hours just to talk about this battle, but I found, especially like the first one, so caught up in it that I didn't even realize we'd finished the hour for the day at the very end.
All three of the hours seemed to go pretty fast for me.
This was extremely interesting. I'm a war gamer, so I found this very, very interesting and very informative about a part of the setting where I'm on, honestly, even after 40 years of gaming in Greyhawk, I am not that familiar with this area. It really never tickled my fancy. And now, and I've read this book so many times, and now reading it in this fashion, I'm now very intrigued by the Adri Forest and what's going on in Nurl, and especially like the Bone March and from, you know, Gary Holly and Spine Castle, which, you know, I'm really a big proponent for, and finding about Stoink. I don't know why I wasn't that interested in realizing about Johnsport. This has become a very intriguing part of the Greyhawk campaign that I haven't addressed really before, and now I'm finding I really love what's going on. Now, it was mentioned in our comments that this was being used as precursor information to the later published Greyhawk Wars setting, and I don't think it really was. I mean, I don't think this particularly was what inspired them to do the Greyhawk Wars. And as we can see, this goes no further. This was a major battle between the Woodsfolk and Ivid, but it wasn't Nyron versus Ivid versus humanoids versus, you know, huge spiraling general warfare. This was just really blunting the Overking. And actually, Nyron comes out of this tremendously well, with very little effort, because of the Woodsfolk. So I don't think the huge events shown in the Greyhawk Wars box set are really leading from this material. All right, I am going to summon up Craig, our recording bot, and end things for today. And I hope everybody's been enjoying this as much as I have, or even half as much, because I tell you, I'm having a great time with all this. So I'm going to say good night. Good night, everybody.